I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is television anchor and journalist Jane Pauley. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Jane Pauley. Many of us remember 25-year-old Jane Pauley's first day as Barbara Walters' successor and co-host on The Today Show in 1976. Let's take a look.
Good morning. This is today, Columbus Day, Monday, October 11th. And in the news headlines this morning, the Palestinians, firing machine guns, have invaded the Syrian embassy in Rome and have now surrendered. President Ford and Jimmy Carter will pay tribute to the memory of Christopher Columbus today as they continue their campaigns. And we'll have a report on the Major League Baseball playoffs. Good morning, everyone. I'm Tom Brokaw on Today. And because of the time differences, this hour is seen first in the Midwest. But we have already been on the air in parts of this country with the newest member of the Today family, Jane Pauley, who comes to us from Indiana and Chicago. And as I said earlier, any family would be happy to welcome someone so bright and energetic and enterprising and just incidentally pretty as well. Mr. Charlotte, would you agree with that?
Yes, I wish you were younger.
No, I ask you not to do that. I signed off Chicago Friday night and I said I'd see everyone bright and early Monday morning. I pressed you all up.
We're early.
Remember? And those of us of a certain age also remember that feeling of dread in 1989 when Deborah Norville arrived on the Today Show sofa next to Jane and Brian Gumbel. TV critic Tom Shales likened it to a scene from All About Eve. Not to worry. Jane Pauley has been called the poster child for second acts. She went on to anchor Dateline NBC and host her own daytime program. And she showed great courage in publicly speaking out about her own experience with bipolar disorder in her 2004 memoir, Skywriting. Most recently, Jane Pauley created the award-winning series Your Life Calling, produced in collaboration with AARP on Today. She's here tonight with her book of the same name, Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. Please welcome Jane Pauley.
I never knew it was Columbus Day.
Oh, really?
It's ridiculous. I wrote a memoir, and little details like my debut was on Columbus Day, had no idea.
So I have to tell you, because you were backstage, you didn't see the clip, but you heard it. The first laughter was Tom Brokaw's hair. I mean, hair is an important thing.
If my husband, Gary, was here, he'd say Tom still has hair. and a lot of it.
And he just interviewed you in New York, correct?
Yes, he did. Tom was at the 92nd Street Y, and he was you.
And
It was wonderful.
And the second, there's so much about that clip. I mean, we remember the embassy in Rome being invaded and Carter and Reagan. But also when Tom Brokaw turns to you and says, "You're so pretty." That just wouldn't happen today.
Nah, from Tom.
I mean, you're still
might.
Pretty.
Yeah,
but you're not allowed. You're not allowed to say that anymore.
You know, and then the what accent do I have when I've opened my mouth and speak? Where did that voice come from? As I assure you, when I was doing the news in Chicago, I did not sound like that. Somewhere over the weekend, I packed my bags. I left Chicago. I'm from Indianapolis, so I worked in Chicago 1 year. Packed my bags, show up in New York City, and appear on the Today Show, open my mouth, and I sound like a cross between Barbara Walters and Grace Kelly. I can't explain that, and I don't know how many months or years it took me to stop talking funny. But I was so young.
Well, you had had
I'm not anymore. You may have noticed that.
You had had this meteoric rise. You went from Indianapolis to Chicago, and the critics were not that kind. They were...
What? You think it's offensive to be described as having the IQ of a cantaloupe? Or being compared to a hood ornament? Well, what's wrong with that? It was Chicago.
Oh, no, really?
Do you know, I was... This is... It was ridiculous, and there's no explaining it. I feel like I'm having a Back to the Future month because I have been this month talking a lot about those early days. But that young woman, and my hair really was that color in those days, naturally. Not anymore so much. But I had been the anchor of the big news in Indianapolis on Channel 8, the weekend edition, 1 year. I mean, by 1 year, I mean 365 days before I turned up. So weekend anchor Indianapolis to Barbara Walters' chair on the Today Show, 1 year. Mm. I can't explain that. It wasn't because, well, Jane, your talent was just so overwhelming. And, you know, it wasn't that at all. It was just... And I didn't believe in fairy stories. I'm from, you know, the Midwest, and you know, I want my thing, explanations to add up. And it troubled me for a long time that I couldn't explain that. No one else cared.
Did you?
When
you say it troubled you because you thought you didn't deserve it?
Oh yeah, it was. And one of the stories in my book, Paul Giannone. Pauly G, if you read the book.
The pizza guy.
Yes, the pizza guy. Said that he was in accounting and then he went information technology, and he said for 20 years he had masqueraded as a computer geek. And it was refreshing for me because, and I think for him to realize how many of us felt or feel like we were or are imposters. But when you feel that way, you don't know that everyone else is kind of feeling that way, too. You think you're alone in that. I was in Indianapolis probably a year or so after that with Dave Letterman, who is also from Indianapolis, and he also had become a network figure. And he and I are talking to some high school kids in Indianapolis. I don't know what the occasion was, but I do remember him telling them, describing his own career. It's like robbing 7-Elevens. The money's good, but you know you're going to get caught. And this was, and I totally related. I mean, I'm thinking, yeah, I know what you mean. This was probably 2 or 3 years before the phrase imposter syndrome was coined. I mean, it's not a legitimate syndrome. It's not a medical diagnosis. But the phrase had not even been coined. But so when Pauly G said, masquerading as a computer geek, got it. I'm with you. Yeah.
Well, just for the record, because I mentioned it in the introduction and everybody nodded their heads because they remember it, because there were only 3 channels then. So we all knew what was going on the networks.
And Good Morning America didn't exist yet. So there were 3 networks, and the CBS Morning News, and Good Morning America didn't even exist yet.
So Today was it.
We had like a 30-something share.
Remarkable.
Which Today is probably at an 11 or 12.
At best.
Yeah.
So what did happen when Deborah Norville came? And did you just say, okay, Jane, start thinking?
Do you know, I really did recognize, along with Tom Shales and everyone else, that NBC had a new plan. I had been there at that point for 13 years. It was a record. I was the longest-running co-host of the Today at 13 years. And so I'm thinking, yeah, I see my successor sitting there. See, she was so smart and brilliant and pretty and ambitious. And if NBC didn't do something, one of the other networks was gonna. So they pushed her in too fast. It was ham-handed the way it was handled. But my reaction was, well, I'm not going to go just sit quietly in the corner and vanish. You know, I was a 25-year-old from Indiana place, and now I've finally, you know, arrived. So why don't we celebrate my 13-year tenure and give me a party? I'll pass the torch. And for some reason, NBC didn't see the wisdom of my idea, and I ignored the reality that I had a contract. It wasn't up. And that it wasn't, their unwillingness to let me out of my contract wasn't personal. It's business. So it was a big media, it was the first media frenzy of my career, and I was at the center of it. When I appeared in what, in those days, there was a center column of the Wall Street Journal, and my sister had a career in business. She was one of the first women to head a global manufacturing and technology company.
And so, you write about her a lot.
And she's all over, yeah. But that when that appeared in the center column of the Wall Street Journal, she thought, oh my gosh, my sister is that important. Anyway, but it all worked out.
Well, it all worked out because yeah. Remind us about your next step and how you were able.
Well, what I did was one day we would have these bizarre meetings every Tuesday. Nobody was saying anything publicly. Either Deborah's picture or my picture was in USA Today every day. I mean, it was, you know, the gossip, you know, ears against the door. Nobody knew what was going on because NBC was radio silence. We were all pretending like nothing's happening, but everybody knew.
Right.
And for some reason we would have these Tuesday meetings. This went on for weeks and weeks. And I would, you know, make my case for just, you know, it's been great. Let me help you move into the future of the Today Show. And then I even predicted, I said, this is going to turn on Deborah if you don't, you know, just let me move on gracefully. Mm-hmm. It did. But the meetings kept happening, silent, radio silence. And one day, as I waited, they would send a car for me in the mornings at 3:30 or 4 a.m. to get me to work. And as I was waiting, I had my notes for the program that day, you know, a big envelope, and I started sketching an outline for a special that I might do. And it would have maybe feature four people in different stages of transition, dare we say reinvention.
Mm-hmm.
So this was in 1989, and I arrived at the Tuesday meeting with these notes, and I said, I think I have an idea of something that we might do together. And I did not know this, but the president of NBC had given the news division 4 hours to fill in prime time. In other words, for specials, news specials. And so Changes was the way out. I stayed till the end of the year, passed the clock to Deborah, produced Changes. It was the highest rated special NBC had ever had, only because of all the publicity that we had described, not because it was terribly important. And that segued into something nobody remembers, Real Life with Jane Pauley, which debuted opposite the Super Bowl. So that, but that segued into Dateline, and
which
11 years.
11 years.
Yeah.
A great success, and then you had your own daytime show, and then that ended.
That ended, what she means by that ended, that it was canceled.
Well,
it didn't,
anyway.
It ended poorly. No, actually, my daytime show was the highest-rated new show of the season. But I was opposite Oprah.
Who was a juggernaut?
Where I wasn't opposite Oprah, I was opposite Dr. Phil. And but do you remember the year Oprah gave everybody in her studio audience a new car?
Uh-huh. So do you.
Yeah.
So tell us about when that happened and when all of a sudden here you were and you didn't have a show, because this is part of talking about this book.
That was
tell
a real turning about, point for me. It was
sorry?
A major turning point for me.
So tell us about your own process in looking for the next thing and what was going on with you.
I am one of the luckiest human beings on earth. To my credit, when opportunities arrived, I recognized them and I took them. You know, I didn't back off and, you know. So that young woman you saw was perfectly aware that I was completely out of my depth. I was no Barbara Walters. You didn't need to tell me. I knew it. But there I was. So the show, the daytime show ended. I was 54. Or I might have been 55, which means that I was a year over that 25 to 54-year-old demographic where humans cease to exist.
Will you explain and, that to people about how they sell ads and stuff?
It's a, you know, the commercial marketing. If you've got a product, you want to sell it to people who are
18
not brand fixed already, which none of us have been forever in our lives and still aren't. And but the young people who buy time for advertising are still kind of stuck. So those demographics still matter. So I was 55. I was now in advertising oblivion, which is not why the show failed. I don't mean to confuse you with that. But with my track record, whenever anything bad happened, there was always something remarkable right behind it. I was a teenager. I was 17 years old when I noticed this lucky pattern in my life already. And I called it the things falling out of heaven theory. And according to my things falling out of heaven theory, at the moment when I thought nothing ever was going to happen to me again, that all of my wonderfuls had happened, then and only then, something would happen. So, honestly, the show ends. It's canceled. It's not picked up. It fails. And I'm kind of thinking, well, the phone will be ringing soon. Jane Pauley's free. She's available. Get Jane Pauley. And nothing happened. And how long it took me to figure out to use the phrase from Trip Hansen, who is one of the stories in my book. Trip said, I knew this time it wasn't going to happen if I didn't make it happen. So I realized at some point I did recognize that I had entered a new phase in the magical life of Jane Pauley, that if anything was going to happen, I was going to have to invent it. I took my time. I took my time. The book is not my memoir. There are 24 or more wonderful stories in the book. I kind of weave in and out of it. But there is, I quote an email from my inbox one morning, Dear Mom, and the gist of it was, I think you have surveyed the field long enough, thinking about what you might want to do, what you might be good at, what your options are. It's time to make your move. Mm. Love, Tom, my son. He was right. What he didn't know, I don't think Tom appreciated, was that I had been very actively actually working the problem and on my sofa, on my laptop, working ideas. I had meetings. I was just, you know, things weren't right until I was in Nashville, Tennessee, in a hotel room with my daughter, Ricky, who's just got engaged.
Yay!
Yeah. And passed the bar. But at that time, Ricky was doing a country music thing in Nashville, And so we were in a hotel room in Nashville, and Ricky, my Rachel is her name, and we call her Ricky. So she turns on the Today Show. She is a big Today Show fan. She has no memory of her mother being on it. But she watches the Today Show, and Willard Scott and Gene Shalit were both on the show that day. That morning we were in the hotel room. And I had had these ideas for like a live event program. I called it Practical Inspiration, Experts, you know, talking about, you know, the future and preparing for it, whether it was, you know, careers or creativity or whatever. And I'm looking at, and it was the first time it dawned on me, these ideas could be television. I did television for a long time. I was pretty good at it.
You're listening to television anchor and journalist Jane Pauley, whose new book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So within a couple weeks, I'd made an appointment and with the executive producer of the Today Show, who turned 40 that day. Oh, dear. But he liked the idea. He didn't want to pay for it. I said, well, what if I found a sponsor? And I had worked with AARP on an award-winning special with a younger woman named Kim Sedmak. And I knew that AARP had a very robust production department. And I intuited that they were having trouble folding baby boomers into an organization.
Oh, yes.
And went down to Washington, and I think Kim and I had a meeting, and sure enough, they were eager to do the program. And we now have done 37 stories. This would be the beginning of our fifth season, and so 37 stories later, and I figured, I think the back of my mind, I don't know if I confessed this to Kim, but I thought if we had 20 good stories, there might be a book.
Yeah. Well, I know that Laura Karstensen at Stanford mm-hmm. was a big part of your research that you did, and
well,
she wanted to be here tonight.
She wasn't a big part of my research. She'd never heard of me or wasn't aware of me. I had read, I'd kept notes in for years on this topic. Mm-hmm. So I would find interesting experts, interesting quotations, and I'd throw them into a folder that I just had been doing this for years, including Laura, who I still have never met, but it turns out she's close personal friends with a friend of mine at Stanford. And so she's in the book, and I have spoken to her by phone. But I lean on experts with actual credentials, people like Laura Karstensen, who is the head of the Center on Longevity at Stanford.
So, formidable. And Hermione is Ibarra, am I saying?
Ibarra from Harvard, yes. Yeah. Now, I've never met her, mm-hmm. but she's, I refer to her like three times in the book. I have watched her. For some reason, I read the Harvard Business Review. I don't know why. I can barely manage to pack my own suitcase. So why I am interested in management, but it's like, why does my husband read the White Flower Farms catalog? It's recreational. But I've been following her work for many years. She does research on mid-career transitions. I'm talking about mid-life mm-hmm. transitions, which may or may not have anything to do with career. But it just seemed to me that everything that she was writing about in her research on career transitions could be extrapolated to, you know, to my interest. So she does appear.
It's interesting that you mentioned packing a suitcase, because one of the things you talk about in this book is when thinking about your future a really helpful way to think about it is the concept of packing for a long trip.
Yes.
So explain that. How does that work?
There is research that shows that when asked to think about yourself in the future, that in test subjects, in MRI, the brain scans, the brain lights up in exactly the same pattern as when a person is asked to think about a stranger. We just don't recognize that ourselves in the future could be someone a lot like us, but not us. So we don't think about ourselves in the future. And would you repeat the question? I've already forgotten it.
Packing for a long trip.
Okay, packing. So if you think about the future, and I do a lot, I took one of those online tests, you know, your temperament and aptitudes and so forth, and I am in the 99th percentile of futuristic. I've already left the building. But I think about the future more than most people. It doesn't frighten me.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize that the future holds surprises, some not good. And I am a worrier. I have children. I am a worrier by nature. And yet, broadly speaking, I feel very comfortable about the future and getting ready for it. And the idea that if you could imagine yourself in the future, what would you want to have packed? And I made a list of things that, like joining book club. 10 years ago, I joined a book club. And my future self will be very grateful for that. And not merely because I will have read more books and I will be more interesting to any future grandchildren than I may have, but I have a social network. And it's been shown that a social network is more predictive of longevity than fitness, smoking, diet. So future Jane will be very grateful. What else? I'm monolingual. I am monolingual in the 21st century, and that's mortifying. Is it too late for me to learn a foreign language? I found a box of French lessons on CDs in a giveaway pile. Gary and I were cleaning up. And I put these, I kept that. I had a long road trip. I was going to visit one of the kids in college. So I was driving up, and I put one of these CDs on to listen to. And before I had left New York City, I was starting to learn French, I think. and frankly, it was so distracting. I was really getting into it. I wasn't paying attention to the driving. And I thought, this isn't safe. And I ejected it. But I thought, I was on the cusp of maybe learning a language.
Mm-hmm.
Take for granted that, you know, you're great cooks. I'm not. I would like to pack 3 dishes that I seem to be obsessed with the future grandchildren, aren't I? Might enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Learning bridge is not on my. I have friends who are, you know, life masters. No. Too late. But this idea of packing for a long trip, when I share it with people, they go off into all sorts of different directions. It seems to be an idea that people respond to. They always respond to it, mm-hmm. but in many, many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
What would the future, the stranger that is you, want in that future suitcase? Because the future is probably going to be a lot longer than you're thinking.
Oh, yes. So before we look at some of the profiles of people that you have discovered, I want to talk about 2 people in your life. First is your husband, Gary Trudeau, of Doonesbury fame, who, of course, you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You speak more than once in the book about how important and supportive he's been in this journey you've taken. You also say he's somebody who just has no capacity for boredom. He's never been bored. And he's somebody who doesn't seem to need to reinvent himself because you were telling me on the way in, he has a new television series on Amazon. I don't even know if we call it
Alpha
television
House.
Anymore. Alpha yeah. House.
No, it's video streaming or something.
Video streaming, Amazon, John Goodman's mm-hmm. in it, Alpha House. He's always...
Well, you raise an interesting point. When my daytime show ended, or when I was advocating my departure from the Today Show, when I did make the decision to leave Dateline, if I think it's time, I'm looking for the nearest off-ramp, and I don't need to know a destination. To be married to me is to think, oh, great, what's she going to do? What do I have? Should I be worried? Is it going to be different? There are couples who may come to a point in life, one of these hinge moments, with separate timings. Mm-hmm. If Gary is going to be more focused on this entertainment realm, what happens to the cartoonist I married? We have a certain rhythm in our marriage. I have an expectation. Now, is he going to be a showbiz guy? What does that have to do with me? I'm going to be completely supportive, mm-hmm. kind of. So, but that's one of the realities you have to factor in. But no, Gary doesn't. The story in the book that's... So he and I are in a car one day, and we're talking about something that I have written in the book, and he makes this statement, I think I have lost the capacity for boredom. And at this point, I start taking notes. And I already knew that Gary had a very active daydream life, yeah. and that he sometimes fantasizes being president of the United States. I knew that. And he says, I'm also in a rock band. I'm taking notes. And he's driving. And then he says, hear that song? Song on the radio? Yeah. I'm playing bass. So Gary says, whenever I'm in a situation that is boring, I retreat to the amusement park that is my brain. He just has the capacity from childhood yeah. to entertain himself. So I don't worry about Gary needing... I mean, he has trouble fitting in all the things that he loves to do. But I worry about, you know, myself. I may find the off-ramp with ease. Change comes easily to me. I am not afraid of it. But the on-ramp that one must then find is not so obvious. And to make a point I left behind earlier, after the daytime show ended, it was 4 years before I figured out your life calling. 4 years of people, you know, what are you up to, Jane? And I'd basically say, and Gary'd roll his eyes, I'd say, well, I'm basically unemployed. And he'd, why do you say that? Well, it's true. And then that would segue, people would say, how are you enjoying retirement?
Ooh.
And am I retired? And I wasn't even 60. So it was with looking, it was a 4-year period of didn't have a good answer to the question.
The other person who comes up in the book, and I just wish I knew her, is your Aunt Martha. Tell us about Aunt Martha, because what a wonderful person in your life.
I mean, my generation is going to live a long time. The boomers are just not going anywhere soon. But we all know people like my Aunt Martha who lived to be 94. The last couple of years of her life, she was an elderly woman. Mm-hmm. But up until about 92, She was in pretty robust, good health. My book opens with a story about a friend of mine named Meg, who was successfully treated for thyroid cancer in her 30s. And every year, the checkup, and on the 10th annual checkup, the doctor tells her, "Meg, I think you've dodged a bullet. I don't think that cancer is coming back." And she comes to lunch, and she's got this horrible expression on her face as we think, "Oh, my God, what has the doctor said?" No, he's given her good news, but the expression on her face is neither joy nor relief. She says, "What am I going to do for 40 years? Yeah, but she was serious, mm-hmm. and she was not happy. She had not planned. I think she'd been living year to year. Okay, so my Aunt Martha was widowed at the age of 50. She had 42 more years. At no point would she ever have thought to ask, "What am I going to do for 40 years?" If my aunt were still living, she'd be saying, "What's all this fuss about reinvention?" My Aunt Martha just got on with life. She had a son to support. She had a job in retail, selling women's clothes. Then she got a real estate license, and then she wanted more regular hours, got a job at a savings and loan, then became manager of the savings and loan. This is not a fantastic career story. You know, this is not a story of my amazing Aunt Martha who rose to run Citibank. It's not like that at all. At the age of 65, she was running the West Lane branch of the something savings and loan in Indianapolis. When she was given her mandatory retirement papers. And she walked across the street, literally, to a travel agency where she was not planning a trip. She got a job as a tour guide. So at the age of 65, she starts leading what my brother-in-law called the bus people, bus tours. You know, they'd go to the Smoky Mountains mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever. But there were a couple tours to Hawaii. There were some to Europe. And she was really good. Everybody called her Aunt Martha. And she loved that. Willard Scott would talk about Aunt Martha. She was such a personable woman and very well organized and great company. And at 75, the travel agency closed. So at 75, she was forced into retirement and still had almost 20 years of life ahead mm-hmm. of her. So the Aunt Martha story is for us to imagine. I'm now 63. In 20 years, I'll be 83. I may still be in robust, good health. Mm-hmm. What am I going to be doing? What if I live to be, you know, 93 and I'm still sentient and you know, what if I am responsible for not squandering this time. Mm-hmm. My Aunt Martha, never occurred to her, because her generation, you know, they didn't take for granted living, you know, you retired, you earned it, you earned the life of leisure. My parents, retirement years came, and my mother who had survived ovarian cancer, had strokes. My mother was an invalid the last 15 years of her life. My father was her caregiver. He was kind of literal about his marriage vows, the sickness and health part. He looked after his invalid wife alone for about 12 years until he became, you know, too old himself to do this. But, you know, that wasn't the retirement they deserved. Mm-hmm. But my generation, we are more likely, if I am aware of my family history of stroke. So I take Crestor. Do I have a stroke? I know which hospital in New York to get to within that golden, you know, circle, so that I don't have the damage. You know, so that we may have health issues and be more likely than my parents were to recover from them. Mm-hmm. I've already had a major health issue, so I'm not, you know, a Pollyanna in denial.
The bipolar
thing. That is still with me. But I've got the opportunity with wellness to live a productive, engaged, creative life. If I'm given these bonus years, I've been given a heads up. My parents didn't. Aunt Martha didn't know how many years she was going to live. But if you know now that generationally speaking, you're going to live a long time, what are you going to do?
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features television anchor and journalist Jane Pauley, whose new book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, we have a number of people here tonight, I know, who you've profiled, and one of them that...
Yeah, we should open a San Francisco bureau.
Absolutely, and come and play in our backyard. We would love that. Jenny Bowen. Tell us about Jenny Bowen.
Now, Jenny kind of... Jenny's here?
Jenny?
When is your book coming out? March 11th. Wish You Happy Forever is the story of Half the Sky Foundation. Jenny's story is probably the biggest story Kim and I have told. And it's a little dangerous for me because, Jenny, your story is so phenomenal that I think it worries me that people might think, oh, do I have to change the world? But that's what Jenny did. You all have heard about the Chinese orphanages and the one-child policy and baby girls being abandoned. And Jenny and her husband have adopted two now teenage girls who were adopted as little ones from China because they read about it in the newspaper. And Richard, I think it was Richard, that said, well, we could bring one home. So they agreed at the table. They have grown children. They started their family young, so they're in their 50-ish, and they decide, well, we'll adopt a child. They meet their daughter in China. It's a long process. Time passes to finally meet the little baby that's going to be their daughter in China. And she had no language because no one had ever talked to her. She probably had been abandoned at a bus stop at maybe age one. She couldn't walk. She had no personality, just a blank affect is how Jenny described it. But they brought her home, and Jenny is a filmmaker by profession. Richard is a cinematographer. And Jenny was editing a movie at the time and brought the editing studio home to the house and had baby Maya on her lap for 6 months while she's editing. Maya's first spoken words of language, he didn't do it, were from the movie. And as Jenny said, everybody laughed, you know, but her heart soared because she knew there's a person in there and she's working. So maybe another 6 months goes by and it's a summer backyard party. This is when the story gets big. Summer party, and Maya is in the backyard romping and playing and singing with her friends. And Jenny has his a kitchen sink looking out the window, has an epiphany. I know how to fix it. And she's thinking of all the other orphans in China, the ones who will never have a family. She knows how to fix it. How to bring the love of family to the children who will never have families. And she does. Half the Sky Foundation is bigger than I can describe, but it is currently working in every province of China. And the Chinese, you can imagine, are not that open to, you know, foreigners, much less, you know, Americans, you know, would you let us help you, you know, correct your problem? But Jenny put it so lovingly, you know, we are so grateful for these beautiful children that you've given us. Will you let us help?
And explain what she's done, the program.
Well, she taught these Chinese orphanages had cribs of hundreds of cribs in a room with two or sometimes three babies to a crib, and caregivers who were untrained and overwhelmed. It was all they could do to change and feed them. And what Jenny's epiphany was is that they could train caregivers. The Chinese word for grandma is Zuma, so nanny Zuma. They trained Chinese women to nurture and bring loving care to these babies. And they were given a pilot program of chance, 6 months, and the changes after they trained these women how to love them up and how to care for them and bond with these children, they became children. They responded like humans. And the Chinese government was rather impressed. And, you know, then that was the beginning of what is scaled up so many, many times. So Jenny's reinvention wasn't just becoming the mother of now two children, Maya and her sister Anya, but has created this Half the Sky Foundation, with a lot of support from other American parents who have adopted Chinese daughters, mostly. And, I mean, that's one hell of a reinvention. But, you know, my goal is to tell stories that people will be inspired by, that are kind of real, relatable, aspirational. But Jenny's was just, I couldn't connect the dots. I couldn't see how she seems so like you and me. Until Jenny explained, she said, everything I had done in my career as a filmmaker gave me the tools I needed. She said, my career as a filmmaker, my job was to imagine a world that didn't exist and make it happen. Whether it was research, writing a screenplay, casting, logistics, shooting, you know, finding the experts that she needed, finding the diplomatic contacts, getting the child development experts in line. She just made all of that happen. The only thing about her story that makes her human is that after all this time, she still doesn't speak Chinese.
Well, you were careful to say that these stories aren't all about changing the world. There's somebody who becomes an acupuncturist. Kirk Rademacher is a sand carver.
And many of you will be into sand carving, I am sure.
A woman who works with therapy dogs, somebody who makes pizza, a comedian. So it isn't all, it's just finding your own path. And so here are some questions that we've collected from the audience. Here we go. Obviously, it's easier to reinvent oneself if you have a financial safety net. What can others do not so fortunate?
Well, you know, I always get that, you know, isn't this kind of an elitist thing? You know, the fact is, it doesn't matter how well off you are. If you have a healthy life ahead of you, then you've got to figure out, you know, how to remain creative, productive, and engaged. And it's not a matter of just, you know, taking a flyer and quitting your job, and, you know, it's bigger than that. So I understand that people who have a financial safety net may have more options. Mm-hmm. But everybody else gets to play this game too.
And has to.
You know, not everyone has to reinvent themselves. Not everybody has to. If you're doing what you are meant to do and it is rewarding, and, you know, change is not the point. It's just that for many of us, we will come to a point in life where we feel the need, the desire, that yearning to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
and we just don't really know what it is. And there are millions of us who are kind of looking. I mean, what after this? What am I going to be doing? I don't have a clue.
So the stories in the book and in the series might just
click a process. One of my favorite chapters is about the golfer Michael Allen. Now, nobody's going to suddenly become a professional golfer. But his wife, it was something his wife said to him when he had an opportunity to go back and try professional golf again. He was a journeyman golfer. He was on the PGA, but he wasn't making any money. Somebody has to be at the bottom of the totem pole, and it was him. So he quit. Has an opportunity to go back. And his wife says to him, "And now we don't need to talk about golf anymore. Just listen to what she said." She says, "If you're going to try it again, this time, do something different. Do something different." And he understood what she meant, that rather than go back to swinging the golf club and playing the game and the same way he always did, to imagine how he might this time approach it differently. And he approached it in various ways differently, with the result that I found him in the newspaper because he won two champions tournaments back to back. That's just not done. And in his 50s, was playing professional golf, beating people he'd never beaten before, the best golf he had ever played in his life. But that phrase applies to all of us. You know, if you are dissatisfied with your work or your career, you don't need to chuck it and wait for some epiphany to do some extreme makeover. Start by just thinking, well, what might you do different? Not differently, just do something different. A school teacher, kill me. I don't want to see those kids anymore. Just how could you approach, teaching history next week differently that would make you more engaged than you were last year without having to stop being a teacher? Because I don't want anybody who's a teacher to not be a teacher anymore. My son's a teacher, and we need more teachers.
Absolutely. So, I know you always get this question, and it's about your favorite interviews, and I'm going to ask you, and you can answer this however you want, but I'm going to ask you to talk about somebody you mentioned in your book who's been such an inspiration to you, and that's Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, he's made that question a lot easier for me. I've interviewed Michael. We are not close personal friends, but I have encountered him over the years in interview situations often enough that there's kind of a little bond there. I first interviewed him on the Today Show when you may have seen him the night before in Family Ties. He was not supposed to be the star, but Alex P. Keaton really made that show. Then the movies, and every 5 years or so he'd be on the Today Show. He went from TV star to movie star to superstar. And then, of course, the Parkinson's happened. By coincidence, I interviewed him probably for real life when he was on the set of Doc Hollywood in Florida. And he didn't mention it, but that was where he first noticed the symptoms of Parkinson in a twitchy pinky finger. Mm-hmm. It was several years later before it was diagnosed. But I had interviewed him over the years, and when he learned that I was leaving Dateline, he called and asked if he could be my final interview. And it was during that interview when I had was recovered from my first and so far only episode of hypomania. I had been very sick, but it was 2 or 3 years later, and I'm interviewing him, and I ask him this long-winded question, I said, in the last year, you and your wife have had a fourth child. You've written a book. You've written a pilot for a television show. He did an animated motion picture. He raised $17 million for Parkinson's research. I said, if it was me, knowing that stress exacerbates your symptoms, I'd be relaxing and taking it easy and conserving my energy. And he responded, and what would you be conserving your energy for? And he didn't know that I had had this illness. I had not yet written Skywriting. He didn't know, and nobody at Dateline knew, that NBC had kind of quietly offered me a daytime show, and I hadn't decided what to do. And when he, what would you be conserving your energy for? And it was pretty much at that moment that I said, well, I guess I'll be doing a daytime show. But, so time passes. Last spring, I've lost track of time. Was it last spring or the year before? Dateline celebrates its 20th anniversary. And they asked me if I would reprise that interview with Michael. So I met him again. He agreed to do it. And I got a chance to ask him the question I'd never asked. I said, why did you volunteer to be that last interview? And he said, well, you'd been there at so many important points in my life. I wanted to be there for one of yours. Mm-hmm. But we talked about, I said, "This, you have such a positive outlook, that buoyant spirit. Do you have to work at that, or is it natural?" And he, that's when he started talking about, say yes more than no. No doesn't move you forward. And at that point, I started saying yes a lot. And I, in my book, I ask, I wonder if Kim noticed the point at which, because she's the one that would always be asking me, you know, can you do this? Do you want to go there? Can you run us? You know, we've got to have their deadline. You know, and I said no too much. Or I'd say maybe, but I meant no. Or I'd say no when I meant maybe. I don't know. But I started saying, yep, yep, absolutely, sure. And I would try to say it so fast that I couldn't start enumerating all the reasons why I didn't wanna or couldn't or shouldn't. And because Michael said, say yes more than no. No doesn't move you forward.
Mm. What a gift.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Thanks to all of you. Thanks, Jane Pauley. Good night.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was television anchor and journalist Jane Pauley, whose new book is Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Chris Howell. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature Haaretz's editor-in-chief Aluf Ben and Middle East expert and columnist Jeffrey Goldberg. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.